This is the Mother Jones Podcast. I'm Jamila King in Brooklyn. On today's show, this is what CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky said this week when she went off script at a news conference.
I'm going to lose the script and I'm going to reflect on the recurring feeling I have of impending doom.
Impending doom. Yikes. She was holding back tears, warning of a fourth surge. But 146 million people in the United States have been vaccinated.
A record-breaking stride. Nearly 3.5 million vaccinated in a single day.
On today's show, a vaccine expert will try to help you make sense of this critical moment where both hope and fear collide. Stick around. When can you hug your grandma? When, if ever, can you ditch the mask? Are we vaccinating fast enough? If you're feeling that America is in a whole new and different phase of this epic war on COVID, you're not wrong. 1 in 6 adults have been vaccinated. If you're doing a happy dance when you hear that number, know that I'm right there with you. You might be seeing the light at the end of the tunnel of this epically long and traumatic and tragic year, but there's still so far to go, and so many questions remain. Dr. Peter Hotez is a vaccine scientist and the founding dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at the Baylor College of Medicine in Texas. He served as a U.S. science envoy under the Obama administration, and he was an early, outspoken Trump critic. Kira Butler, a senior editor and public health reporter at Mother Jones, talked to Peter Hotez about vaccines and variants for a special Mother Jones live stream that happened last week. Today, you're going to hear that interview. Here's Kira Butler in conversation with Dr. Peter Hotez.
Dr. Hotez, welcome.
Thank you.
So I want to start by talking about two topics that are on a lot of people's minds, vaccines and variants. Despite a swiftly moving vaccine rollout, after months of decline in cases, we're beginning to see some small upticks in some places, and we're hearing that variants are becoming more widespread. In the war between the vaccines and the variants, who's winning so far?
Well, it could go either way. We're kind of at a tipping point. And the good news is we are starting to vaccinate the American people. We're up around 25% of the U.S. population that's gotten a single dose of vaccines. And, you know, the Biden administration came out with a plan right after the inauguration saying they were going to do 100 million immunizations in 100 days and vaccinate the American people by the fall. But then we saw this B.1.1.7 variant coming out of the United Kingdom. And we knew from studies conducted in Europe, out of Denmark and the U.K., that this virus is more transmissible than anything we've seen before, and about 60% more transmissible and higher mortality. That's a paper in Nature, and higher hospitalization. A paper came out of Denmark. So, you know, what we advised the Biden administration, the scientific community, was great plan, but you're going to have to go back and redesign this because we need to get the American people vaccinated much earlier if we're going to get ahead of this variant by, you know, summer, late spring at the latest. And they did. They put forward a new plan. They procured more vaccine. They listened to the scientific community. So the good news is I think we're going to be in good shape by the summer, partly because the vaccine seemed to work just as well against the B.1.1.7 variant in the UK as the original lineages. So that's great news. And also now we know the performance features of these vaccines, at least some of them, that they not only interrupt symptomatic illness, which is what we knew from the phase 3 trials, but from the real life situations in Israel and Scotland, it shows they actually stop virus shedding from the nose and mouth and actually block asymptomatic transmission. So it means by the summer, I think we could potentially vaccinate our way out of the epidemic. That's the good news. The not so good news is this B.1.1.7 variant is accelerating in Texas, Georgia, and Florida, and up in Michigan, up in New York and New Jersey. So this could go either way at this point. If we can continue to vaccinate, if we can convince some of the governors to hold off on relaxing mask and social distancing restrictions, I think we can keep us at a flat level. If we don't, then the numbers are going to start to go up and we'll see a fourth wave. And it's sort of precarious right now. You know, everyone is remarking on the fact that we've gone from 250,000 new cases a day to 50,000 new cases a day. And that's great. That's an 80% decline. Those are confirmed cases. That's still a high level, even that 50,000 number. That's the level we were at last summer when we were all wringing our hands that everything was falling apart. So we feel good that it's gone down 80%, but it's still a screaming high level. And so we're at a very dangerous time right now.
We're hearing that some variants, such as the P1 variant that's dominant in Brazil, may not be vulnerable to the vaccines that we have. What's your sense of that?
Well, you know, when you looked at the B117 variant, I don't want to get too much into chemistry, but that's a consequence in the spike protein of what's called an aromatic amino acid substitution that causes tighter binding of the spike protein to the receptor. And that's likely translating into higher transmissibility and higher virus replication and therefore higher mortality. But the vaccines still work. So the antibodies to all these vaccines work by inducing virus neutralizing antibody. The problem that you get in with the Brazil variant, the P1, and the South African, the B1351, if I'm not driving you all crazy with the numbers, is that those virus neutralizing antibodies don't neutralize as well. So the virus neutralizing antibody titers go down, and that translates into decreased effectiveness. They can still partially protect, likely, but not as well. And we have two examples where we've actually looked, because the J&J vaccine and the Novavax and the J&J vaccine were both tested in South Africa and shown to be partially protective. So that does worry us about Africa and Brazil and therefore Latin America. But those two variants are not here in a big way right now in the U.S. And when I've spoken to some of the virus genomics experts, like my colleague Trevor Bedford, they seem to feel that the UK variant is going to be the dominant one for the foreseeable future in the US. And therefore, don't be surprised if later on this year and or into next year, we all wind up getting another booster.
I wanted to talk briefly about the AstraZeneca vaccine that's been under some scrutiny these last few days. There were reports first that the vaccine had caused blood clots. Then we heard that it didn't. Now we're hearing that AstraZeneca may have used out-of-date data. Just yesterday, there was a report that Dr. Fauci called this an unforced error. What is going on here? And how can we prevent scientific errors like these from undermining vaccine progress and vaccine acceptance?
Well, the way I describe this is, you know, the big vaccine producers are not really in this in a big way. I mean, historically, the three largest vaccine producers have been Merck and Company, GSK, and Sanofi Pasteur. And they're not, right now, they're not in a major way. Merck is going to help out. Merck and Company is going to help out with the defense production, through the Defense Production Act. They'll help out with making one of the adenovirus vaccines, I believe the J&J vaccine. So the companies that are in it right now, Moderna, AstraZeneca, are not really vaccine companies and at all. And so they're new to this. And I think there seems to be a lack of understanding of how public perception can quickly derail public confidence in a vaccine. Or as I like to say, it doesn't take much to vote a vaccine off the island, even if it's a good vaccine. And in the US, you know, they've procured so much vaccine that I think, you know, even if public confidence in the AstraZeneca vaccine is not high, it may not have that big an impact. The problem is that I see is in Africa and Latin America, we don't have a lot of options. You know, look at the enormity of the scale we're looking at. 1.1 billion people in sub-Saharan Africa, 650 million people in Latin America, two doses of each vaccine. We're looking at 3 to 4 billion immunizations that we have to do. And we know the mRNA vaccine technology is still new. You're not going to get that kind of scale out of the mRNA vaccines, at least not now. You realize there's not a heck of a lot out there for Africa and Latin America. So the AstraZeneca vaccine was the workhorse one we all expected for Africa and Latin America. And if public confidence is eroding in the US and Europe, we know what happens. It translates pretty quickly now to Africa. I mean, you know, when France suspended the use of that vaccine, and immediately, I'm sure it had a very detrimental effect in Francophone Africa that takes its cues from France. And we're going to need that AstraZeneca vaccine.
So this is actually a great segue. I wanted to talk a little bit about a concept that you write about in your book, vaccine diplomacy. Can you explain that concept?
Yeah, it has to do with the fact that vaccines are so powerful in terms of their impact on public health, and therefore all everything that goes along with it, that the technology has enormous ramifications for foreign policy. Like, for instance, when Edward Jenner developed the first vaccine, he was called upon to mediate prisoner exchanges with the French during the Napoleonic Wars. And Thomas Jefferson brought vaccine over to give to Lewis and Clark and in their explorations in the wilderness as a goodwill gesture for Native American populations who were being decimated by smallpox. And that's continued, that thread of how vaccines are used as instruments of foreign policy continued with Albert Sabin, who developed the oral polio vaccine. Not many people realize he did it jointly with the Soviets at the height of the Cold War. He got permission to send his polio strains to the USSR right after the Sputnik launch, one of the worst times in the Cold War, the two countries putting aside their ideologies to work together. I worry we've gotten away from that now because there's been this erosion in the governance around vaccines. What you've got now are the Russians and the Chinese are not going through normal regulatory mechanisms, stringent regulatory authorities, and instead doing these kind of one-off bilateral relations with countries in a very transactional manner. And the default plan is to rely too much on the multinational companies who are going to produce good vaccines, but not necessarily vaccines that are suitable for resource-poor nations in Africa and Latin America and elsewhere.
Coming up after the break, why some people might not be able to get a coronavirus vaccine for years. That's all ahead. Stick around. And hey, we really love and appreciate the fact that you're listening to this show right now. And one very simple thing you can do to support us here at the Mother Jones Podcast is hit that follow button wherever you're listening, Spotify, Apple, Stitcher, whatever the platform is, just hit the follow button and it'll help us out a lot. Thanks. Mother Jones stories you're hearing right now are brought to you by our listeners and loyal readers who fuel our work. Audience support makes up 2/3 of the Mother Jones budget and helps our team dig deep on stories that matter. Make a donation at motherjones.com/give to keep our nonprofit newsroom humming. Again, that's motherjones.com/give. Welcome back to the show. You're listening to Mother Jones senior editor and public health reporter Kira Butler as she interviews Dr. Peter Hotez, a professor of pediatrics and vaccine scientist at the Baylor College of Medicine in Texas. He's been leading a team at Baylor to develop a coronavirus vaccine that uses older technologies and would be cheaper to make and sell than the newer vaccines. Let's tune back in to Kira's conversation with Peter Hotez.
While the United States is on track to make COVID vaccines available to everyone here by next month, we're hearing that in other countries, it might be years until people have that kind of access. What happened? Did the United States just hog the whole world's supply?
Well, I think there was a couple of things. I think right off the bat, there was a problem that still has not been widely acknowledged. They went very heavy on innovation. Innovation was top priority in some ways. And they wound up producing very interesting vaccines, like the two mRNA vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna, and the adenovirus-based vaccines, and the protein particle vaccines. But those vaccines had never been scaled before. The consequence was the companies could produce just enough for North America and Europe. And, you know, and then if something were left over for low and middle income countries, great. So it's not that there wasn't a good faith effort to try to ensure equity. I think, you know, the WHO and Gavi, the Gavi Alliance, and CEPI worked together to create this COVAX sharing facility, which is brilliant in its design. The problem is the vaccines aren't there to provide to the COVAX facility because they can't be scaled at the level we need. I mean, I think it's almost as if nobody took a step back and realized, hey, we're talking about 1.1 billion people in sub-Saharan Africa and 650 million people in Latin America. It's 3 to 4 billion doses. We can't, there's just no way you're going to do that with the mRNA vaccines or maybe even some of the adeno or protein particle vaccines.
It's great to hear that you're working on greater access for people around the world. We also have an equity problem here in the United States. You know, it's becoming clear that while we're making great strides in the vaccine rollout, some Black and Brown communities are still being shut out. Is there a way to apply the concept of vaccine diplomacy here in the United States? Or maybe if not vaccine diplomacy, then just a greater focus on equity?
It's much tougher, I've found, to get people to care about diseases of the poor in the United States than anything we've done in low and middle income countries. And I still don't understand why. I mean, once again, when COVID-19 hit, one of the things that I first saw was this was decimating Hispanic neighborhoods here in Houston. And that was also really hard to get people to care about it. And that was one of the reasons why I was so out there, you know, debunking the disinformation campaign that came out of the Trump administration and around this time last year. And because, you know, not that I was one of the first to call it out, not because I'm so brilliant, but because for years, decades, I'm going up against the anti-vaccine disinformation. And so I've learned to know and smell anti-science disinformation campaigns a mile away. And I saw this unfold, you know, coming out of Peter Navarro in the White House and Larry Kudlow, and was one of the first to call it out. And that was very tough for me because, you know, the message as a scientist is, you know, you're not supposed to just stick to the science, Peter, just stick to the science. You're not a political guy, just stick to the science. And finally, my wife, Ann, saw how upset I was getting. And she said, look, you know, if you don't want to wait till next year and you see the number of people who've lost their lives from COVID, and especially in Black and Brown communities, and not say anything, you'd never forgive yourself. So that's what I did. And it took me to a very dark place that I'm still going through. And it's very tough to go up against the White House. And I'm glad I did it, but I'm still feeling the effects of it.
Let's talk a little bit about the role that anti-science movements play in all of this. There's long been an undercurrent of this in the anti-vaccine movement. But you write in your book that the culture of misinformation has really taken hold in the last few years in different parts of the world. Can you say a little more?
Yeah, unfortunately, this has become a powerful and very damaging force. And Carrie, you know, the two of us have been speaking about this all during 2020 and into 2021. And, you know, the anti-vaccine movement has a thread throughout American history, but in its modern form, it took off starting in the late 1990s after a publication of a paper that was shown not to be valid by Andrew Wakefield and his colleagues in London, claiming that the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine had the ability to cause autism. At that time, they called it a pervasive developmental disorder. But it didn't get retracted till 2010. And this gave an impetus to ignite an anti-vaccine movement. It was all garbage. There was no evidence for any of that. And so I spent a lot of time going through the scientific literature, and the scientific community responded each time. And also talking about what autism is, because I have a daughter with autism and intellectual disabilities. And I wrote this book called Vaccines Did Not Cause Rachel's Autism that also reports how autism begins in early fetal brain development through the action of 100 genes and how we did whole exome sequencing and Rachel and my wife and I. So all of that, I think, had a positive impact in kind of tamping down the fake assertions of the anti-vaccine lobby. But then they re-energized in an odd way that I could not have predicted. Starting in 2015, they aligned themselves with the Republican Tea Party. So sort of political extremism on the right, especially in Texas and Oklahoma, under this banner of health freedom, medical freedom, saying, no, no, you, government can't tell us what to do. So over time, this is it's shifted from sort of the far right to the of the Republican Party to a mainstream platform of the Republican Party. And we saw that play out in 2020, where they glommed on protests not only against vaccines, but masks and social distancing. So this became a full-on anti-science movement with deadly consequences. And so this is a full-on empire now. My belief is that this, and I don't know what you want to call it, an empire or a confederacy, but it's very powerful. It's very well organized. It's well funded now. And the consequence is that this is leading to deaths, right? And I see this as a very potent force, as potent as anything that we've built infrastructure to combat, like nuclear proliferation or global terrorism.
Dr. Hotez, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Dr. Peter Hotez in an interview with Mother Jones senior editor Kira Butler. You can watch the video of this live stream event on motherjones.com or on our social media channels like YouTube and Facebook.
I'm Andrea Guzman, and I'm a fellow in the San Francisco office. Right now, I'm working on a story about the push for tougher hate crime laws lately and how others oppose these efforts and instead seek non-carceral solutions. Here are the credits for today's show. Theme music for the Mother Jones podcast was composed by Micah Barrick at HearFilm. This episode was produced by Mark Helenowski, our managing producer, and James West, our executive producer. It was mixed and edited by James West and Molly Schwartz, our associate producer, with additional production by Kira Butler and Jamila King. And credit where credit is due. Mother Jones is supported by you, our listeners and readers. So thanks.
That's it for this week's show. I'm your host, Jamila King in Brooklyn. As always, it's so easy to support the Mother Jones podcast. Just hit that follow button on whatever platform you're listening to. It really helps us out. And we'll see you next week.
This podcast is brought to you by Mother Jones listeners like you who donate to keep our newsroom buzzing. Help us stay on the beat. Go to motherjones.com/give.
From PRX.